This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
We're upset too, despite the fact that they already graduated a few years back. In fact, many of these alumni are still studying Japanese to this day, which proves that the program's influence does not end in high school. But the most surprising group to support us, I think, is our fellow students at Grant. Many people who aren't even taking Japanese have been coming up to me and expressing their disbelief, saying that it's a big part of the Grant High School community. We've also been getting major support online. When we created a Facebook page, we received more than 100 likes in the first few hours. In addition, the petition going around Grant High School collected more than 400 signatures, and the online one had signatures from all around the United States, and even a few from Japan. I didn't think that anyone outside of the Japanese program would care so much, so it was wonderful to hear. The fact that so many people support us has been astonishing and incredibly encouraging. Although a lot of us complain about Japanese homework or tests, we honestly do care. Sometimes we forget the value of our own program, but it's times like these when we realize how much of an impact it has had on our lives. Japanese is a really interesting language, since it's so different from any romantic language such as English, French, Spanish, or Latin, which are the other languages offered at Grant High School. Besides knowledge of the language, the Japanese program has given us a vastly different perspective of the world and influenced the way we think about our own American culture. Not to mention, the two high school teachers, Paige Sensei and Luffer Sensei, are the most dedicated teachers I've met. They stay at school until 6 p.m. every day, when every other teacher has already locked their rooms and headed home. They take pride in the entire program and how far it's come. It seems like a lot of work for just the two of them to take on. Really, if Grant had the money, three teachers would be better. But seeing as that's not an option, they somehow managed to do it all. I suppose what I've learned from all this is that you have to fight for what you believe in. Despite the fact that the immersion program is continuing next year, we might still have cuts, lose classes, or even lose a teacher. It might again be in danger of being canceled in upcoming years. This has been a wake-up call for all of us, and I think we've all become more appreciative of this opportunity we've been given. As for the neighborhood program, if it goes away, it would be a hard blow. These classes open up the program for everyone in high school, allowing them to experience a culture and a language so unlike the one they're used to. Cutting the neighborhood Japanese classes would be a step in the wrong direction and would mean lost opportunities for many students. I thank Portland Public Schools and the Grant Administration from the bottom of my heart for keeping the immersion program, but neighborhood Japanese truly completes the program. I beg, please, let's listen to the hundreds of supporters we have on our side. Let's offer these wonderful opportunities to all students. Let's keep the entire Japanese program whole and of high quality. Thank you. My name is Sarah Onitsuka. I'm a junior at Grant High School, and this is my APA call to action. If you're interested in supporting this cause, please like our Facebook page titled Save Grant Japanese and sign the petition at savegrantjapanese.tk. Non-Facebook users can email savegrantjapanese@gmail.com to have their names added to the petition. Thank you again.
Oh my God, you guys, I'm so excited to be here! So excited! I hung out in Portland for a week, and I swear to God, I need to not feel the pressure of peers because I really want to get a tattoo. So this is what I decided. I want to get a tattoo. It's going to be two words. It's going to be all capitals. And it's going to say, Chinese tattoo.
My name is Luann Algoso, and you're listening to APA Compass. Today, we're speaking with Los Angeles-based writer and comedian Jenny Yang. Jenny was one of the top three finalists out of 90 comedians in the California's Funniest Female Comedy Competition in 2012. She has performed on the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts stage in Washington, D.C., and at comedy clubs and colleges throughout Southern California. One of her biggest projects to date is her co-founding the first ever all-female Asian-American stand-up comedy tour, Disoriented.
Yeah.
Welcome, and thank you for coming on the show today, Jenny.
Thank you.
So tell us about how you started in stand-up.
How did I start in stand-up? Well, I've written all my life, tortured youth poetry. And then I performed it in college when I realized people performed their poetry. And I was surrounded by an awesome community of student of color activists. And then when I graduated college from Swarthmore College, I found an amazing space in Little Tokyo in Los Angeles called Tuesday Night Project or Tuesday Night Cafe, and which is an amazing network of Asian American artists who twice a month for like over 14 years have been doing this free multidisciplinary sort of performance space at open mics. So through that, I really was nurtured to perform my poetry, which tended to be either really silly or really sad. And then over the years, people would just say, oh, yeah, you're like a comedian. And finally, I made a bucket list because, you know, you're only young once. And I decided I'll be open to creative opportunities. And one night at a slumber party, one still does that sometimes. a friend of mine, after I was telling a story that everyone was laughing at, she was like, hey, Jenny, you're like a comedian.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I heard this before, but I'm actually going to be open to hearing it this time. Right now, I will declare that I'm going to, you know, do an open mic stand-up set before my next birthday. And that's what happened.
How old were you when you had the slumber party?
Oh, God. Let's say I was not a teenager. It was about 4 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, great. So that's what happened. And from there, after wanting to throw up, after doing it, and it felt horrible, and I probably did all those sort of first-timer hack jokes, potty humor. I think I used the word dingleberries. I don't know why.
What's dingleberry?
It was probably a genital reference. I don't know. So because of that, I still kind of thought, wow, like, this was really scary, and I haven't been so scared in so long. I probably could grow from this, so let me do it more, because I'm a glutton for punishment. So yeah, that's how I got going. And I've been doing it ever since, pretty consistently. It's a lifelong journey, Luann.
Yes.
It's a lifelong journey.
So what would you say is the kind of comedy then do you perform?
Let's see. It's tough because I've only been doing it for maybe 4 years now, while pretty much most of the time working a full-time job. So I think most comics would say that 7 to 10 years is when you really find your voice. But I'm pretty sure that I'm always going to think the way I think, which is a lot about race and social justice issues, and just about identity and family. So, and just silly things like tapioca milk tea and the alternate life that I'd never lived as a rapper. So that's So yeah, I think a lot about race, and I talk a lot about being Asian American, being woman, being woman. I like how I didn't even say being a woman. Being woman.
Just being women.
Yeah.
All women.
Plural. Just plural. Yeah. So I talk mostly about race, I would say, and identity.
And so what do you like most about being an Asian American comedian? And what would you say that you like the least?
I think what's tough is that Asian Americans are still very invisible in most entertainment arenas. Mm-hmm. So most public arenas, Asian Americans are invisible. Mm-hmm. I think little things will pop up in the sort of public eye, like Margaret Cho or Long Duk Dong or Psy or William Hung, She Bangs, which is really all just variations on a theme. So, and I feel like there's still a lack of kind of, I don't know how to put it. There's a lack of understanding of Asian Americans as being multifaceted and full human beings. And so I think the positive part about being Asian American as a stand-up comedian is that I'm very proud of being Asian American and an immigrant. And I like to talk about it because it's a big part of who I am. It is who I am. And therefore my comedy will talk about it. And the sort of downside of doing stand-up and talking about being Asian American is that not a lot of people do it. So I think, you know, in a general comedy space, if it's not like an Asian American community space, there's usually a very basic threshold of understanding that most of the audience members need to have in order to understand maybe some of my stories or my perspective. And so I found myself, you know, I took my share of sort of ethnic studies or Asian American studies classes as an undergraduate. And I think approaching doing stand-up, I realized, wow, like, if I want to talk about things, I really have to get very clear about, you know, my opinions about being Asian American, because it's almost like, how do you make things funny but also understandable for a general audience who might not have taken Asian American Studies 101?
Right.
You know, so it's little things like we're diverse. You know, it's like a weird label that we're Asian, or I'm not going to make math jokes, even though I'm really good at math.
Right.
You know, but I do refer to it. You know, it's tough because on the one hand, I am kind of a model minority, which is, you know, what most Asian Americanists would say is bad because it hides, you know, some truths in our community. And so on the one hand, I can fulfill that stereotype. And on the other hand, I'm doing stand-up comedy, which really doesn't fulfill that stereotype.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm kind of good at math, I have to admit. I can't deny who I am.
Right.
I got straight A's. Yeah. I'm very proud of that.
And you did well.
So that's a struggle.
Yeah.
So that's a struggle.
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, it's like I do – people are – in stand-up, the first thing you learn is that you – have to deal with what stands out about you that makes you look different, whatever that means.
Right.
So if you're a little chubbier or fat, then you gotta just deal with it and move on. Otherwise, most audiences won't will kind of get hung up. Like, doesn't he know he's kind of fat? Shouldn't he talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
It's like this weird psychological effect. It's like a very basic lesson. So, you know, I know a lot of Asian American comedians who don't even talk about being Asian American, which, you know, I feel like I think most of them can pull it off, you know, but most of them, they'll refer to it at least once. Yeah.
So do you feel that you need to then, just because you are Asian American?
I don't feel like I need to. I feel like I'm very different from even other comedians who happen to be Asian American.
Right.
Because I'm already very, very race conscious.
Right.
So it's not like I had to. It's like I will, because that's just how I think, and that's how I present myself, or I want to, that's the conversation I want to have with people, you know, very deliberately. So that's that's why I would talk about it. Other people who don't care as much about race, I know that they struggle with the fact that, like, oh God, I guess I have to talk about being Asian, you know, which, you know, it's, that's their journey, that's their identity. But, but for me, it's a very important part of who I am and how I think, and why I wanted to do stand-up. It's because I wanted to be able to talk about the things that I always wanted to talk about, you know?
How do you measure good comedy?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of ways that, like, people will laugh. Everyone can laugh at a lot of things. But what I believe is good humor, in my capital C definition, is stand-up comedy and humor in that arena is best when you are not bullying those who already get bullied. That's that's my preference for what good comedy is. If you're really good at making fun of people that most people make fun of already, that's not that hard, you know? And oftentimes Asian Americans are on the one of the lowest on the totem poles when it comes to that. So for me, I believe good comedy is the ability to make fun of those who are in positions of power rather than those who are often disempowered. So, and that makes it harder. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like, how do you talk back to the bully and make it funny and awesome? And I feel like a lot of people who get into stand-up comedy tend to be people who, you know, maybe felt voiceless, or maybe were the ones who were beat up or whatever.
So where did the concept of the comedy tour come from?
Well, after doing stand-up for a couple years in L.A., I met amazing. You know, you want to find a community, right, of people to inspire you, to support you. And a lot of it is also going to open mics or getting stage time with each other so that you can practice and learn and get better. And I met a lot of white female comics, actually. And they're amazing. I think, though, what was tough is, you know, I was struggling because I thought so much about race and from an Asian American perspective, which is the sort of rules around what it means to talk about race as an Asian American is not very clear in the public sphere. And I think we're always constantly trying to define it and tell people, this is how you need to talk about us. This is how you need to respect us. You know, we're going to do a show where literally I'm just going to put together all the Asian American female stand-ups that I can find and just see what happens, you know, and see the diversity of the kind of comedy that we do. And then, you know, definitely through that, when you do shows together, you kind of hang out in the green room, you build some relationships from that, you know, and kind of get to know each other. So That was really the initial impulse, you know. And it was really through a conversation with Yola Liu, who's based out of Seattle. Mm-hmm. She had just started stand-up, and I found that this random, I think I get a Google alert. It was like, Asian American stand-up or comedy. And she showed up in the Northwest Asian Weekly, like this feature on her, and she only just started. But I'm like, hey, I wanna know who this person is. So I actually just contacted her online. Because I have no shame, because that's how I met you.
Yeah, exactly.
Luann.
Yeah.
And I just said, hey, you're cool. Like, yeah. I just wanted to know who you are because you do stand up and you're Asian American. Yeah. And we did like a Skype date, and we like got to know each other a little bit. And I just kind of threw out there, like, man, wouldn't it be amazing if like someday we'd have enough of a critical mass and kind of energy and momentum that we could just do a tour that's only Asian American females? Because I don't know if you know what mainstream comedy is like, but it's almost like it like brings a tear into the matrix if like people put together two women on the same bill back to back on a stage in a set, you know, in a lineup.
Yeah.
There's these weird unspoken rules about how you kind of put together a show. And so God forbid there'd be like eight Asian American females
right.
all in one show.
Right.
What does that do to people? Oh my God. You know? So that's why. So when we, and Yola and I were talking, I was like, yeah, what if we did that? And it's like, yeah, someday. Yeah. And then the next time we talked, she goes, you know what? I was thinking about that idea. I think we could really do it. Let's start in LA because that's where it would naturally
right.
be a good place to start. And that's where I'm based.
Yeah.
And that's how it got going. And I recruited Atsuko Okatsuka, another amazing comic that I actually met when I first started doing stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a writer and actress as well.
And why the name?
Disoriented Comedy?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of comedy shows out there that are like ethnic.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to, and they usually involve food or some kind of like stereotype.
Okay.
So we wanted to find something that probably told you what we were. There's a lot of show names out there that are like, it's Latino night, it's the red beans and rice night, or it's like like they'll do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We wanted to go somewhere a little more subtler, so we said mm-hmm. Disoriented Comedy. And it actually gets to be a little more expansive of a definition, because the Orient has been redefined many, many times over
mm-hmm.
back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that gives us an excuse to be like, oh, my Persian and Iranian American stand-up comedian friend, we can have her on the show. We have a Egyptian American. Egypt at some point, I'm sure, was weird to white people.
Sure.
Back in the day.
Right.
And they called it Oriental. So we're like,
yeah.
Let's have Egyptian American Maria Shahada on, mm-hmm. you know, for mm-hmm. Disoriented Comedy. So, and, you know, unfortunately, we haven't really found many queer Asian American, queer-identified Asian American
right.
female comics. Though we have had D'Lo who identifies as transgender boy. But so one time we just said, you know what? We get to do what we want. So we're going to feature Liliana Cervantes, who's Latina. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we wanted it to be just tell you what we are, but just be expansive enough so that we could kind of show the diversity of what we were trying to do. You know, I want to produce a show down in L.A. that's called The Black and Yellow Show. I have a buddy who...
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of friends who are black comics and Asian American comics,
mm-hmm.
and the vision, I mean, it's all still kind of get worked out, but mm-hmm. the point is that we want to, the flyer's going to be black and yellow. We're going to play the song Black and Yellow.
We're going to
play a lot of Wu-Tang Clan,
yes.
You know, maybe Kung Fu Fighting, but that's a little racist, that song. I don't know, but
yeah.
you know, and then feature black and Asian American comics. Mm-hmm. Probably I'm going to try to do it at this sort of black comedy club in
mm-hmm.
LA,
mm-hmm.
And see what happens,
mm-hmm.
and maybe make some of the proceeds benefit the Asian. I need to run this by my co-producer, so let's not put this down in writing, but
right.
and then maybe benefit like the Asian Pacific American Dispute Resolution Center, which does a lot of mediation and conflict
awesome.
Resolution. Hello.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm
How
picturing.
Is that not like a, right?
yeah.
Anyway,
right.
so the
yeah.
little so there's fun projects that we get to do, and we get to kind of engage in a entertaining dialogue so that people will think about stuff and not know that they're thinking that. And actually, this is a part of a writing project that I've been working on, which is about, you know, how do we redefine what it means to be a good Asian? You know, it's time, you know, it's really time
yeah.
to just say it, and let's just name it, and let's give examples of how people, you know, maybe didn't graduate from college, even though college is a really great place to graduate from, who are Asian American and who still make a life that's worthwhile and meaningful, you know, that's not necessarily attached to money or what have you, but that you can survive and you can still thrive. So it really is just, I recommend people just talking to people who are living a kind of lifestyle that you are interested in, just asking like, how do you make it, you know, how do you make it through, just because it's such a broad statement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think figure out side hustles, you know.
Yeah,
There's so many ways, you know, still do a day job, but like work on stuff on the side. If you really love it, it's like you got to put in even just 30 minutes a day. You know, I think that's the thing. When I started doing stand up and people heard my story that I quit my previous career in politics to do it, just after I performed, people would just come up to me like, just like, it's as if they were like coming up into like a Catholic confessional, you know, and they'd just be like, oh, I want to be a good Asian, but you know, and I want to do what I love. I'm just so scared. I want to quit my job too. Like so many people would tell me these things of variations on these themes. And it just indicated to me like how much there's so much hunger for people in our community to get inspired and empower themselves and get the courage to do what they want. And we need to do that for each other, you know, because we're not going to get that from any sort of mainstream media or other examples. Right. And so I think that really hit home when I would sort of get that feedback from people that they were struggling with being so unhappy with whatever they were doing. And we don't want to be no statistic. We're already like, aren't we like the most like likely to freaking have mental health issues as a subgroup or something? Come on. You got to figure out some way to be happy, you know? And so I think we need to kind of take it easier on ourselves and let ourselves explore, you know. And I also have really supportive parents. Like they're not like booking shows for me, but like, you know, they've know that I'm an independent thinker and I'm taking care of myself, you know? And I think, well, you'll be surprised, like people that like your own family or your community will let you be and how expansive they'll let you be despite what you're afraid of, you know, what they would think. Right. Mm-hmm. If you were to do sort of a non-traditional type of job. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, we could talk about this forever, Luann.
Jenny Yang is the co-founder for the Disoriented Stand-Up Comedy Tour. For more information about the Disoriented Stand-Up Comedy Tour, check out disorientedcomedy.com. This is Luann Algosa for APA Compass.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. My name is Andrew Ye. On today's show, we're chatting with Selena Yoon, award-winning author of approximately 200 children's books. Selena is based in San Diego and visiting Portland, Oregon for this year's Wordstock Festival. So shout out to our Wordstock friends for bringing her to town. Selena, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Could you introduce yourself to our listeners, please?
Sure. My name is Selena Yoon, as Andrew said. My specialty is in novelty books for children. And what novelty books are books for the youngest readers, I would say from babies to about 3 or 4 years old. These are books with pull tabs, wheels, touch and feel elements, fabric pieces on the books, pop-ups, all kinds of books like that. Each one is quite unique, and I love creating them. One distinct thing about my books is that I don't have one particular style. There are lots of authors, lots of illustrators, where they have a distinct style, like Eric Carle or Karen Katz. But what makes me unique is that I don't have one style. I change from project to project. I think about what sort of art style would be best suited for that particular book and attempt it. I experiment a lot with art.
Some of these things that you mentioned that are in your novelty books sound like they would be impossible to actually translate into e-books. Do you have any plan for adapting to e-books?
That's a very good question. My books are so interactive. I have to say e-books, for me, would destroy the fundamental beauty of the novelty book, which is that you interact with the book, and not with buttons, but with how things move to touch the book, the way that the book is shaped, how they feel in your hands. I think that adds to the fun and pleasure of these books. So my book is the antithesis of the e-book. I want kids to have to hold books in their hands and not necessarily digital devices.
Did you have any role models or heroes?
I can't say that I had a specific role model. You know, my parents, they're immigrants from Korea, and I saw how hard they work. In fact, we took very few family vacations. Seeing how hard my parents work, I naturally felt the need to work just as hard. You know, after I keyed in on what I wanted to do, I really just didn't give up. It was very, very important to me that I get to what I wanted to do, which was to publish books. And one wasn't enough, and I made it a goal one year to sell at least 5 books a year. But I've exceeded that goal, and now I publish approximately 10 books a year, and that's where I'm most happy.
You know, being an author or artist is kind of a non-traditional career. Was your family supportive of it?
My parents were nervous about it when they heard that I was going to leave my salaried job at InterVisual Books to just freelance, which essentially to them, it sounds like, well, now you're just unemployed. And that is true because there are no guarantees as a freelancer. I've had years where I have only sold maybe 2 or 3 books, and those I would call are my lean years. And I remember my mom being so worried. She's like, well, maybe you can teach. She was getting information from me on community colleges locally, but I refused. I really felt that I could do this if I was just given the time to, and with any career, it does take time to develop.
So I know you have 2 kids of your own. Do you do anything special to promote their cultural awareness?
We visit my parents frequently in Los Angeles, and so they understand that they are half Korean. But it's funny because at a certain point they were they couldn't remember. They're like, "Wait, are we Chinese?" And I'm like, "No, you're Korean." It was, are we Japanese? And so that's probably my fault. But you know, I don't go day to day explaining to them that I'm Korean. But when we go to my parents' house, Korean is spoken in the house. I speak to my mom in Korean, very loose Korean. And so they understand that, oh, wait, this isn't English. And one time I remember my son saying, is that Spanish? I said, no, it's Korean. So it's funny. Maybe I haven't exposed them enough. I try to. But in my day-to-day life, it's not as obvious, you know, that we're any different from anybody else. And so it's harder for them to remember, you know, my heritage anyway, which is passed on to them.
Many of your books have animal characters, but you also have people characters in some of your books. When you're designing the people, how do you choose their ethnicities?
Well, you know, I tend to actually avoid illustrating people. I do have some, but as you've said, most of my characters are animals because that's what I'm most comfortable drawing. And also, I feel like if it's an animal, then more kids can relate to them emotionally. My animal characters take more on, a childlike persona. But I grew up in Los Angeles, and so it's a very diverse community there. And so I naturally have diversity, I think, in my books as well. If you see any books with children, most likely there's more than just one child, so it's not just one main character. It's just natural for me to change the skin tone as I go, you know, from one child to the next, because that's what I grew up with, that's what I know, and that's how it should be. It's every child should pick up a book and be able to identify with at least one of the characters.
Selena Yoon is a prolific author of award-winning children's books. Could you give our listeners your website?
Sure. My website is selenayoon.com. That's spelled SalinaYoon. And you can preview my current picture book right on that site, Penguin and Pinecone, A Friendship Story.
Selena, thank you so much for talking with us today.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you so much, Andrew.
My name is Andrew Ye, and you've been listening to APA Compass. Thanks for listening to APA Compass. My name is Andrew Ye, and it's my pleasure today to be speaking with Dr. Anne Wetherill, who is an adjunct professor of art history at Portland State University. Dr. Wetherill and Jim Carman are co-curators of the exhibit Flying Tigers, Chinese-American Aviators in Oregon, 1918 to 1945. The Flying Tigers exhibit has 3 parts: the history of aviation in Oregon, the stories of several Chinese-American aviators from Portland, both men and women, and a beautiful timeline, which places aviation and the Chinese-American story into the larger historical context. And when many of us think of the early history of aviation, we remember the Wright brothers' flight in 1903, and not much else. How does Oregon fit into this early aviation history?
In the early 1900s, Oregon became very interested in aviation, especially during the Lewis and Clark Exposition of 1905 or 1907 here in Portland, because Lincoln Beachey flew his dirigible Gelatine over through Swan Island and then over to Vancouver, and people were just absolutely captivated with aviation. Portland describes itself as being aeronutty. People like Julius Meyer and then Henry Wemmy, who the town Wemmy is named for. Henry Wemmy had the first motor car in Oregon, and he was determined to have the first airplane in Oregon. So what we have are these early 20th century businessmen that see the commercial potential of aviation in Oregon, in the Portland area. And so they're bankrolling these builders and these engineers. How this includes China, or how the Chinese become involved in this, is that in 1906, Moi Bak-hin, who was a Portland businessman, becomes the Chinese consul for the entire Northwest. And as we have the last dynasty, Qing Dynasty, fell in 1911, the republic that was born then really perceived aviation as the key to a modern future. And so the Chinese Republic was recruiting Chinese-American pilots heavily to send them back to China to found flight schools and manufacturing plants for any kind of aircraft.
How did the Flying Tigers exhibit come about? And where did the initial idea come from? And who really drove the project?
I had a chance conversation with a man named Keith Lee a couple of years ago. He came up to me and he said, have you ever thought about doing anything on the Flying Tigers? And I was thinking, well, tell me more. I don't know anything about this. His father was one of just a handful, 8 or 10 Chinese, that went back to China as a member of the original American volunteer group. His dad came over as a paper son, thought he was going to be deported, and he ended up then going back to China in 1941 to serve in the U.S. military as part of the American Volunteer Group. Keith told me that story. It's an amazing story. And then he asked me to come look at photographs, because his father had photographed his entire time in China. He had access to darkroom equipment and camera and film, and it was really a fascinating glimpse of that particular period in history. I thought that it would make a great exhibit, and then I spoke to a member of the Chinese community, Rebecca Liu, who told me about the Swan Island Flight School that was established for Chinese-American pilots. It was a project of the local Chinese Consolidated Benevolent Association, and they established this flight school in 1932 and 1933 to train pilots for the Chinese-American pilots in Oregon for the Chinese Air Force. What is interesting about this is that Moi Bak-hin, who was that Chinese consul, was able to steer a Chinese government contract to a Portland flight school in 1929. And so that is where these first group of students come. So it's funded at that time by the Chinese government, but the Chinese government is here recruiting Chinese-American pilots to learn to fly. Portland's Chinatown, at the time of the turn of the century up to the first quarter of the 20th century, was the second largest Chinatown in the U.S. So there was a lot of political and economic clout here in Portland.
You featured Arthur Chin,
yes,
also in the exhibit, right?
Uh-huh.
So Arthur Chin is also known as America's first ace during World War II.
Yes.
Could you tell a little bit more about his story?
Arthur Chin was from Portland, and he went to Benson High School. He dropped out of Benson in order to train to become a pilot. He was amongst the first group in 1932 to go to China, joined the Guangdong Air Force. He was such an excellent pilot that he was one of 8 cadets that were sent to Germany to train with the Luftwaffe in 1935 and 1936. And he also won medals from the Luftwaffe. He came back to fly for China in 1937 at the outbreak of the Sino-Japanese War. He was shot down in December of 1939, and suffered severe burns on his hands and face and was disfigured. But he was able to, he survived. He came back to the U.S., was in hospitals undergoing operations on his face for about 4 years. He came back to Portland in 1944, and he was really welcomed as a great war hero and favored son, which indeed he was. So he's an extremely interesting and charismatic character. There were comic books written about him.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw there's a comic book there. I wasn't sure what the title of the comic book was, but the section that was open was entitled China Warhawk, right?
Yes, yes. So I think it's America's Heroes. I think that's the name of the comic book. He was on radio programs. There was lots and lots of photo ops with him. He was also in New York at war bond drives. He was a very public figure. He went back to China to fly transport for the U.S. in 1944. He retired in 1950 and then came back to Oregon and worked for the U.S. Postal Service. He finally wanted to finish his high school degree, and so he graduated from high school in 1986, the same year his grandson graduated from high school.
That's funny.
It is.
So how did he choose a career in the Postal Service?
I don't know. I think that there were just not a whole lot of things that they were going to allow him to do. He was a great war hero, but this is 1950. This is before civil rights movement. There was really still a tremendous amount of discrimination against Chinese Americans in the 1950s, even as decorated a war hero as he was.
How about Hazel Ying Lee?
Oh, Hazel Ying Lee is a very interesting person. She also was from Portland. She was one of two women that trained at this Swan Island flight school. And then she went off to China to try to serve in the Chinese military, but they turned her down because she was a woman. So she stayed in Canton and in Hong Kong and flew commercially. Once World War II broke out between the U.S. or the U.S. enters the war, she became a buyer for the Chinese military and came back to New York. She joined the WASPs, the Women's Air Service Pilots, and was the first Chinese American woman to fly for the U.S. military in that way. And she was also the last WASP to die. She was killed in a collision flying transport for actually some of the really big planes, some of the fighter jets.
What's Leah Hing's story?
Leah Hing, she is a very colorful character. I'm sorry I never met her because she was alive until 2005, I believe. She was from the Portland area. She was recruited by a man named Tex Rankin. He wanted to create a flying circus. He had a African-American flyer. He had a Native American pilot. He had a white pilot. These are all women. And then Leah Hing, who was the Chinese pilot. The flying circus, I don't think, ever really took off. But she had her own plane. The plane is now in the collection of the Pearson Airfield in Vancouver, Washington. And so you can go see this biplane. She served as an instrument mechanic or an airplane engineering specialist in Portland during the Second World War. And after that, she never flew again.
The cultural climate was pretty tough, I think, for Chinese Americans at the
time,
right?
Yes, it was.
Right?
It was.
And so what sort of obstacles did they have to overcome to actually become aviators? Were there maybe personality traits?
For the Chinese American pilots from the Portland area that went to the flight school, they had to be bold and determined. Alan Greenwood, who was the instructor, was interviewed in the paper multiple times about these students, and he talked about them as being the most mentally tough and the best pilots he'd ever trained. And they were really heralded as heroes. And in going to China, I'm sure that they were treated as heroes there as well. People like Arthur Chin, that name is still well known. And both in Taiwan, and then he was inducted into the U.S. Hall of Fame.
What did you expect when you first envisioned this project? And how did it actually turn out?
I wasn't really sure how I was going to envision the project. It was much richer than I thought it would turn out. But one of the questions that I kept coming back to in reading about the Chinese that were involved, knowing that there were other Chinese communities around that also were involved in aviation, and I kept coming back to, why Portland? Why would this have happened here? I was really struck by the fact that Portland was so interested in promoting aviation, even Chinese American aviators. And this did not occur in other communities. Portland saw these students as really these great heroes. Also, it has something to do with the fact that Portland was in competition with Seattle for being the center for aviation in the Northwest. And so Portland was throwing everything it had into aviation. It's just throughout that first quarter of the 20th century, the focus was really on flight here in Oregon. So that was also one of the kind of things that helped made it a very fertile place for this story to spring up. I was really pleased with how the exhibit came together. What was exciting for me was at the opening reception when a man came to it and he grabbed my arm and went over and looked at this photo. His uncle was in the photo and he had never seen the photo before. So this means something to a local community, but also it sheds some light on what has really been an ignored and basically forgotten piece of Chinese American history. What I would really like to see happen is that a documentary be made about this. Mm-hmm. I think it would be ideal. And there are still people that are alive that remember. And so we need to take advantage of that now.
Ann Wetherill, thank you for talking with us today and bringing this little-known thread of Chinese-American history to our attention.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Ann Wetherill is the co-curator of the exhibit Flying Tigers, Chinese-American Aviators in Oregon, 1918 to 1945. I'm Andrew Yeh, and you've been listening to APA Compass.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to APA Compass. I'm Kushlani D'Souza, and today I'm speaking with author Catherine Chung, whose debut novel, Forgotten Country, was recognized earlier this year as one of five novels honored at the prestigious 2013 Penn Hemingway Literary Awards. Catherine Chung studied mathematics at the University of Chicago and writing at Cornell University. She's currently a fiction editor at Guernica Magazine. Forgotten Country tells the story of Janie, a young Korean-American woman whose family secrets begin to surface during her search for a disappeared sister and her family's return to Korea after 20 years in the United States. Thanks so much for talking with us on APA Compass.
Thanks so much for having me, Kushlani.
Let's start with the title. What is The Forgotten Country here?
You know, I really like the title Forgotten Country because I thought it could refer to the Korea that Janie left behind as a young child, but I was also interested in the Korea that existed or is imagined, the idea of the Forgotten Country as the homeland or the lost homeland or the history that you're always searching for or that you miss, that you're not sure you can find your way back to.
Like your main character, Janie, you grew up in a Midwestern suburb that was, at times, xenophobic. But Forgotten Country reaches far beyond that American experience, as far back as the Japanese occupation of Korea. What inspired you to tackle these multiple histories rather than focusing on those things closest to your own experience?
Oh, because I think stories always start so much further back than we know. And I think that when we grow up, you know, we think this is my experience, right? Like me living in the Midwest or you growing up in the U.S., like this is what makes us who we are. But I actually think that what shapes us goes back further.
Now, I understand that some of your own family's secrets served as an inspiration for certain aspects of Forgotten Country, including this lost sibling. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
There was this story that I grew up with, which was when I was in high school, I found out that my father had a sister that I had never been told about and that she had disappeared when he was a child and that the family thought she had been kidnapped by North Koreans. And she had sent a letter, which is how I found out about it. And so I began to just think about the things that I didn't know about my family and the things that I didn't know about my history. And I began to think about why I didn't know those things and the historical context of why something like that would be hidden.
Now, throughout Forgotten Country, Korean folk tales play a really important role. And I wonder, did these stories come out of research, or did you grow up hearing these kind of tales?
So the folk tales, actually, I grew up with. My parents told me Korean folk tales, they told me Greek myths, they read me children's books, and they were a huge part of my childhood. And I wanted to bring them in, partly for the same reason that I wanted to bring in this history for Jamie, which is just that I think stories that we learn growing up are part of how we shape our identities, or they help us figure out how the world works, but in a sort of invisible way, in the way that history can work, it's sort of invisible influences on us.
Is there any particular story that stands out as something that really resonated with you and you knew you wanted to write about?
Oh, yeah. I think storytelling is sort of a huge trope in the book. The stories that the characters tell each other, the stories that the characters keep from each other, the stories that they tell themselves. And so in terms of folk tales, one is about Shim Chung. And she is one of the most famous heroines, I think, in all of Korean folklore. And she's a girl who, you know, is beautiful and dutiful and filial, and she loves her father. Her father had actually went blind from sorrow when she was born because her mother died in labor. And so the girl ends up finding out that if her father were to donate 300 bags of rice to the temple, the monks would pray to restore her father's sight. So she volunteers for the price of 300 bags of rice to jump off this ship to placate the dragon king who lives in the sea. And so she does this, and she's so beautiful that a lotus flower takes her into itself, and then it's this giant lotus flower that's presented to the king, who discovers her and falls in love with her and has a feast for all the blind men. And when her father comes, they meet again, and he hears her voice and his sight is restored. And so that story, you know, when you're growing up as a kid and you hear that story, you want to be this girl, but it's also a very, very interesting lesson, which is the extent to which you should sacrifice yourself. And also, she's a girl, and so the idea that if she had been a boy, she could have worked and supported her father. So part of the tragedy of that family is that, you know, she's just a girl.
So her only value is her body and the extent to which she'll sacrifice it?
Yeah. Yeah, and so that was a story that I was keen to engage with.
So you grew up hearing these folktales, but I also understand that you grew up speaking Korean and you didn't come to English until you started school. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how that transition might affect your writing now, right? That movement from a Korean-only household to having to navigate this new language.
Yeah, well, I think that the transition was actually pretty traumatic at the time. Although, you know, when you're a kid, you just kind of deal with what's going on. You don't think about things like trauma. But when I was sort of first deposited into my school, it's kind of funny to remember, because I don't think that I understood what was going on. And I didn't realize when my mother left me there for school that I would be surrounded by people who only spoke English. And I didn't know my own name. So I have a Korean name, which I had always been called. And then I went to the school and I didn't realize I'd be called by this other name. And so it was just a lot of bewilderment. And I needed to catch up very quickly. And the first school I went to was also a school in which we had prayers every day. So I was a non-Christian in this Christian school and a non-English speaker in this English speaking school. And I think that the bewilderment of that made me really desperate to communicate, and it really informed my relationship to the English language. And I think that I learned to read and write much earlier than I learned to speak fluently. And so I was always actually more comfortable in the world of books and in the world of the written language. And I think that it was partly because it felt safer. You know, when you speak to somebody, there are so many turns of phrase or manners of speech that don't make sense unless you are kind of part of the club and you understand slang and various things. But the written language always seemed like something I could navigate.
That makes sense that something written would feel safer, that there's a buffer between you and the person or people you might be trying to communicate with without that immediate face-to-face risk that you're taking when you have a conversation with someone.
Right, right. You know, and even just talking to you now, I feel like my preoccupation in the book with the lost history or the lost country, I think begins with this first loss, which was this loss of language, which feels kind of like a loss of home. The discovery that the world is, you know, the world outside is very different from your sort of interior home.
So when our listeners get a hold of Forgotten Country, I think they'll find there's a kind of precision that I wonder about. Do you think your background as a mathematician influences your writing in general or the approach you took to building this novel in particular?
Yeah, you know, I think that it does. I think as a mathematician, you learn to try to be sort of as clear and as precise as possible. That's part of the language of mathematics. But I also think that part of my style comes from my relationship with the English language. I feel like it is my native language, but it also, it's not my mother tongue, if that makes sense. And so because of that, I like things to be as precise and clear as possible. I think that I was drawn to math because it is precise and because it tries to create a sort of order out of chaos, right? Like math is always trying to explain how things work in the universe. It's trying to order and create structure and create meaning in a way that's actually similar to storytelling. You can create narratives out of math in a way that somehow seems related to me in terms of creating narratives in literature. And so I think that what I'm drawn to in math is something that I strive for in my writing.
Katherine Chung's debut novel, Forgotten Country, was recognized earlier this year as one of five novels honored at the 2013 Penn Hemingway Literary Awards. Congratulations again, Katherine, and thanks for joining us today on APA Compass.
Thank you so much, Kushpani.
Good morning. This is Kushlani DeSouza with the latest edition of Pop Watch, where we here at APA Compass keep an eye on the good, the bad, and the absolutely awful when it comes to Asian Pacific American representation in the media. General Motors showed some good sense after bad this week when it pulled its new ad campaign for the Chevy Trax SUV. The commercial features a stylish retro look and sound. Here's a clip and listen closely to the lyrics. Did you catch that? That's Austrian musician Parov Steller, who based this song on a 1938 tune called Oriental Swing. Surely that should have been somebody's first clue that this wasn't the greatest choice. In case you didn't catch them, here are some of the lowlights. Now in the land of Fu Manchu, the girls all now do the Suzy Q saying Ching Chong Chop Suey. Ching Chong Chop Suey? Seriously? That's racist. Unfortunately, this tried-and-true tactic of using nostalgia to excuse flat-out racism is not the only problematic aspect of this story. The media coverage of GM's advertising mess has also been disappointing. On the upside, many major and minor news outlets ran the story. But the downside? Virtually every headline suggests that GM's racism exists only in the paranoid minds of a few of us oversensitive Asian types. Now, the New York Daily News and AOL's auto page are notable exceptions, but almost every other news headline announced that the Chevy ads were decried or were criticized as racist.
The passive voice here focuses our attention on the complainers and criticizers, not on the ad's actual racism. When the headlines did call the ads racist, they put the term in scare quotes. GM pulls, quote, racist, unquote, ad. Again, suggesting that only some people, translation, those humorless Asians, had a problem with it. I understand that some folks will deny the ad's racism, and they'll claim that the media is just acknowledging this lack of consensus. But we can make the same argument for the media's overuse of the word terror to drum up fear of foreigners and support for war. Many critics find this term questionable at best, but terror seldom runs in air quotes. In the mass media, terror is always real, but racism is merely perceived. These two media tropes absolutely fuel one another, and there are real consequences for people of color here in the United States and elsewhere. The all-white cast in the commercial who grin and glimmer in sepia-toned glamour as they drive their tracks to the nightclub, they certainly don't seem to be offended. As always, whether they intend it or not, racism just makes them shine a little brighter. They don't mind a little retro racism. And anyone who does? Well, I guess we just don't get the joke. That is offensive to anyone who recognizes that racism of any stripe hurts all people of color and props up white supremacist culture, which, I might add, is bad for white folks too, perhaps more ethically, theoretically, and karmically than practically speaking. Anyway, hopefully you get my point. I'm glad GM has yanked the commercial, and I'll keep my eyes and ears open for the next round. That's this month's edition of Pop Watch. I'm Kushlani D'Souza. Thanks for listening.
Cascadia. Today is Friday, May 3rd, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. In Chicago, a young Muslim American man is in court today, another victim of an FBI sting. And we have CARE's Robert McCaw, who prepared the testimony on the constitutional and counterterrorism implications of targeted killing, submitted to the Senate Committee on the Judiciary and the Subcommittee on the Constitution. This is more solid work from the Council on American and Islamic Relations. And we will have we have other guests talking today about some passing strange appointments that President Barack Obama has come up with. Nicholas Johnson joins us to parse the FCC choice. First, this from the National Weather Service. Today, sunny skies, and it could get up to 80. Light winds, 5 to 15 tonight. Clear skies, lows around 50. Of course, it's always cooler in outlying areas, and still breezy. Saturday, it'll be another sunny day, highs around 80, bit breezy. Saturday night follows straight along with a 50 to 55, and it could get a little bit windier. Sunday, breezy, bright skies, and hot, 80 to 85. Sunday night, clear, starry skies, lows 50 to 55, which brings us full circle to Monday morning. We are going to hold the alternative forecast today, because we have a number of guests joining us to take a look at some rather odd developments. Moving right into it, we're going to be speaking with Robert McCaw with the Council on American Islamic Relations regarding an incident. This is regarding some testimony that he prepared. This comes close on the heels of hate crime charges that CARE has brought for an alleged assault on a Virginia Muslim U.S. Army reservist and veteran, reportedly attacked by a man who allegedly compared him to those who carried out the Boston Marathon bombings. This today, but what's in process right now is CARE's testimony regarding the targeted killings that are being dished up by drones in the skies over Muslim countries. Good morning. Thank you so much for being with us today, Robert.
Hey, thank you for having me, Chris. How are you?
We're well here, and we wish we could say the same for villagers in places like Waziristan and
sure.
Yemen. Out of the sky, for no reason, comes sudden death and destruction. There's an echo from Vietnam, only this is far deadlier and far more insidious. And nothing governs. And so far, the receiving end has been. I can you think of any target that has not been Muslim? I mean, this.
Well, I think that the targets, especially in countries like Yemen or Pakistan, they would be Muslim just by these countries being predominantly Muslim. What's concerning the CARE and a number of national civil rights organizations is that, according to the New American Foundation, at least 276 to 368 civilians have been killed in the past several years in Yemen and Pakistan, as well as 200 to 300 individuals that we don't know whether they were civilians or militants. And on top of that, the Obama administration has a policy in which any male of military age killed in one of these strikes that would be a bystander, not a person particularly targeted in this attack, are usually counted as militants themselves. So whether they were militants or civilians, sometimes it remains to be seen.
Well, it does seem true that the way the Obama administration and presents it, the dead guys were the militants, right? And
sure.
and everybody else that managed to survive the attack, those are the civilians. It's just simply not that way. I've read accounts of by villagers. Of course, recently the many gentlemen who gave extraordinary testimony of the effect of drone attacks on his village. Can you talk a little bit about what the effect is having on the survivors in these places?
Sure. And I would just like to say that I was actually at that hearing last week, the Senate's first ever hearing on the constitutional and counterterrorism